To talk with Art Bell, call the Wildcard line at area code 775-727-1295. The first-time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll-free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call Art at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art Bell by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
In the presence of Charles Seitz this night, and Charles and I are going to have quite a conversation in a moment because, you know, over the years, many years now, I have interviewed some of the best minds in America. Best scientific minds, certainly, mathematicians, people like Charles, and of course, Michu, and many more over the years. And there's one thing I've found, and that is that when you really pin these guys down, and I mean you really pin them down, they don't believe in God. They don't believe in God. That's all. The theoretical physicists, the mathematicians, the astronomers, the scientists in general don't believe in God. Some will, when asked the question, of course, sort of hedge around a little bit and allowing for at least the possibility of it, I think more to satisfy some listeners than because of their own belief. But by and large, it's true. Most scientists don't believe in God. And you know, when you get things like the Big Bang and all that was coming from that which is so small it can't even scientifically yet be detected, I mean, that's quite a story, you know? Quite a fish story. Even with all the evidence of the energy and all the rest of it, it's quite a story. This Big Bang and this infinity that we're asked to consider, something that goes on forever, all of this is quite a bit to consider, and still at the same time be able to reject the concept of a God, a controlling entity, a creation force, to be able to reject that. Now, in a moment, we'll ask about that. Remember the movie Contact with Jodie Foster, Charles?
Yes.
Yeah. You remember when the scientist was sitting in the seat and there were representatives of Earth, you know, government and everything, interviewing him, trying to determine if he was the right guy to go through the wormhole to meet with the aliens? And the last question, of course, was, well, do you believe in God? Will you carry the word of God and that we believe on Earth to these aliens? And he sat there and said no. You know, so he couldn't take the ride. The ride was unavailable to him because he didn't believe in God. Most of the scientists that I interview on this program, in the end, Charles, they don't believe in God. Why do you think most scientists, underline most, not all, don't send me emails, most scientists don't believe in God?
Well, I think it has to do with the fact that science has a breadth. It has extreme power in a certain sphere. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you go outside that sphere, it loses its power. If you don't have experimental evidence or some way of examining a question, it is beyond what you can look at.
Like the what happened before the Big Bang, what was around before the Big Bang, they don't know.
Yes, you can do a little speculation. You can go a little bit beyond the edge, but you can't go too far, because then it stops being science and starts being philosophy or even religion.
All right, well, so what is it about science that dictates to these learned men and women that there couldn't be a creative force behind it all?
Well, I think it's more that they don't see any reason to go to a God.
They can't explain it.
No, they can't. But in some sense, God punts the question forward a little bit. if there is an immortal being that was the creative force, then what created that creative force? And you can say God is eternal. But in the same way, you can say that the universe is eternal. And in fact, there are some theories, one is called eternal inflation.
So in other words, put another way, eternity might not have anything to do with a creator.
That's correct. The universe might have always been here on some level.
Hmm.
And so it when you ask a scientist, do you believe in God, they may not, but it certainly has nothing to do with their scientific beliefs.
Mostly not.
Mostly not. Although I have encountered quite a few very religious scientists. And in fact, I was lucky enough to go to a conference at the Vatican a number of years ago for the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. And there were some of the most eminent scientists in the world who were deeply religious there. I mean, Charlie Townes, for example, who invented the laser, was there. And I was privileged to meet him and George Ellis, who's the head, who was very high in the Quaker Church in South Africa, and also just a great cosmologist and scientist.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Those involved in cosmology, like yourself, it's very rare that you find a belief in God.
It tends to be, again, with exceptions. And at some point, you have to be able to accept mystery. Whether you're religious or not, you either accept the mystery of God or you accept the mystery of the universe. And where you place that mystery determines whether you believe or not.
If you were on your deathbed and you were offered an opportunity to continue to exist in the same mental state you're in now, except in a machine, would you accept that?
Hard to say. I guess if I'm on my deathbed, yeah, pretty much.
See, you're right in there with that group, pretty much.
Yeah. You caught me.
Most would say, no, I am prepared for the other side. Let the Lord take me now, and I know what awaits me, and off we go. I don't want to live in no machine.
I wish I had that certainty, actually. There's a comfort. There's a comfort knowing what's beyond death. And uncertainty is uncomfortable often. And atheism is often uncomfortable in that sense.
Atheism is almost itself a religion. It has to be. To believe that strongly in something, it's almost exactly like a religion in a lot of senses.
In some senses it is, but in some senses it isn't. It's a negative belief in some sense. In the same sense that not believing in purple monkeys is a positive belief. It's also a negative belief that just because you don't believe in purple monkeys doesn't make you a non-purple monkey believer. If someone handed you evidence of purple monkeys, you might become a believer. But absent that belief, absent that evidence, you don't have that belief. That's kind of a twisted...
Well, in today's genetic unraveling world, purple monkeys could be just around the corner, so I wouldn't reject
indeed.
That at all.
That and then I'd become a believer.
Monkeys.
Also, I think they've actually got glowing monkeys, or at least they've got glowing zebra fish now.
That's right. They're beginning to get to the point where they can take the attributes or whatever from one animal or one mammal and transfer them to another. This all has me very worried.
It's like lots of technologies, it's got great pluses and great minuses. Nuclear power, for example, has the potential to solve a lot of the energy problems, but at the same time, it can destroy civilization. And genetically modified foods can make it much easier to have and distribute food, but maybe if genes leak into the environment, they can cause super weeds or something like that.
Yes, I'm very concerned, and I wonder how concerned you are, watching what science is on the verge of right now in so many areas, just so many areas. I mean, nanotechnology is a pretty good example of where they're marching ahead into I'm not sure what, and I'm not sure if they're sure what. Science is doing a number of things today, like the HARP. Are you familiar with HARP?
Yes, I am.
Oh, you are?
Mm-hmm.
HARP, I've got a story here, which I read in the first hour, that HARP has now actually managed to create, in effect, an aurora.
Yes, I think that was in Nature recently.
That's right, yes. They actually created an aurora. Now, if you can do that, if you can beam something from Earth and cause the ionosphere to jump around like jelly and start creating lights and all that sort of thing, you're beginning to manipulate forces that you don't have the first idea of the outcome.
Well, there can be lots of effects, but actually, that's one of the electromagnetic radiation is something that scientists do have a pretty good handle on. It's the auroras that the effects of that are a little less certain. Mm. I'm more worried at what would happen if they start using that for advertising.
Well,
could you imagine these glowing signs at night saying, drink Coke?
I know. That's what was actually suggested by the scientists when they were asked about it, to either light up cities or, put advertisements up in the sky. I thought that was, I don't know, perhaps a little disingenuous on their part, Charles, because I don't know. I think they're working on other stuff. The Air Force is up there. All these lettered agencies are up there. And I just don't think they're working on the Coke in the sky idea.
Probably not.
Probably.
Although, you often see projects, first real displays in almost commercial senses, like the Russians had this enormous banner called Znamya, where they tried to illuminate, use a space mirror to illuminate, make a large spot on Earth of light.
What happened to that?
I think it failed. I think that it failed to unravel properly, but I'm not 100% sure. That was about 6 or 7 years ago.
Well, we're noticing on the shortwave bands that they're really screwed up, and many of us believe that HARP is the leading that march at the moment.
I would tend to think not, just because it would be local. However, I think that there is a great deal of solar activity right now. I mean, anything that we can do on Earth is dwarfed by what's happening naturally on the sun.
So we're always told, yes. But I think the whole concept of HARP is like a very small force comparatively creating a very large effect, or at mm-hmm. least that's what they're hoping for.
Yes, and I remember some of the early reports. I remember reading a very funny article talking about how HARP was causing caribou to walk backwards. It was. I tend not to believe that, but it's just whenever you have a shroud of secrecy around a project, you always get a lot more worries than are necessary, even though there might be some worries to them. Like the there was a project, I think, in the Midwest somewhere to signal submarines, and they would have a low frequency signal that submarines could hear out in the ocean. Again, I'm only dimly remembering this, but some people thought that this was responsible for the Taos hum and had other much more sinister purposes than they actually were for.
Now, with regard to the Taos hum, I really like the idea of deep burrowing government machines myself.
I'd love to see them.
just scorching through the earth from one secret site to another. That's widely thought, by the way.
Is it?
Yes. Listen, let's talk a little about parallel universes.
Mm-hmm.
Parallel universes, we sort of touched on it in a way, but occasionally brushing. Do you believe, Charles, that we'll ever get an opportunity to perhaps extract information from another universe?
I think it's unlikely in our lifetime, but it's not impossible. In fact, some scientists, like David Deutsch out in England, believe that we already have evidence of parallel universes. And he's not on the fringe at all. He's actually a very mainstream quantum theorist.
And that evidence being?
That evidence being the very nature of quantum mechanics itself, that you have some very bizarre behavior of particles that are very small, that are in the quantum realm. They can do things like superposition, where it can be in two places at the same time.
At the same time. That seems so... That's like trying to get your mind around infinity. One object being in two places at the same time, folks.
Yeah,
that's what we're talking about. They've proven this, right?
They've observed it. They've, in NIST in Colorado, I believe, a number of years ago, they took a single atom and put it in two places at the same time.
IBM did something with light or something. I can't recall.
IBM, I think, did a teleportation thing not so long ago.
That's it. Well, that's essentially, for an instant at least, doesn't that mean the object is here and there?
Actually, the object is destroyed as soon as it's transported, so it's not in both places at the same time, but it uses a similar technique, something called entanglement, where two particles, even though they might be halfway across the universe, feel what happens to the other one. If you measure one, the other feels the measurement.
Yes.
Instantly.
Yes.
And David Deutsch thinks that by positing parallel universes, you can explain all of these effects in a very natural way. And there's quite a number of scientists who believe in what's called the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, that superposition and entanglement all are things happening on various parallel planes. For instance, a particle which is in superposition, an atom in two states at once, two places at once, is really a particle in two different sheets, and the sheets are on top of each other.
Why doesn't this explain telepathy or something like that? In other words, a thought simultaneously occurring to two minds on opposite sides of the planet, just as an example.
Well, in fact, a number of people are trying to figure out whether entanglement is related to telepathy. There is a foundation in Switzerland created by a banker, Marcel Odier. And the Odier Foundation funded a number of really good experiments, really good scientific experiments that went in peer-reviewed journals having to do with teleportation and entanglement.
All right. An even more fascinating one might be that experiment, the experiments going on now at Princeton.
The Paralab?
Oh, yes. Yes, I'm talking now specifically about the Human Consciousness Project. You don't know about that? Oh, it's so fascinating. What they've done is they've taken computers and scattered them geographically around the world, reporting back to Mama Computer at Princeton. And these computers are constantly generating random numbers.
Yes.
And then Princeton is keeping track of when this randomness becomes not so random.
Yes, I know this project.
Did you note that before a lot of big events, like before 9/11, for example, the spike just went damn near off the chart 3 hours before the event itself? Now, you were talking about quantum entanglement, and we were talking about time as another... we were saying time was another dimension, possibly. Well, if it went off the chart, registering some kind of human consciousness spike 3 hours before the event itself, that says all kinds of things about all kinds of things. And if you go back to many very large world events that have occurred, you see similar spikes prior to the event itself. Now, what does that suggest might be going on?
It indeed would suggest something very strong, that there might be a world consciousness. However, I looked at some earlier data a number of years ago, and I wasn't very impressed with the numbers. I would have to take a look at them again.
And you should.
And you, what the very, with a scientific experiment, you have to be extraordinarily careful with controlling what you define as a hit.
Yes.
And in the past experiments, for the other famous psychic experiments, like the Stanford Research Institute experiments of the 70s, part of the problem was a flexible definition of what a hit is.
Well, Princeton is so sensitive to what you're talking about that they won't really come out and talk about the program itself for fear of affecting their results. Just the mere knowledge of the existence of the program, they worry, might contaminate the results.
That's a big problem, because science always relies upon transparency and repeatability. If another lab was able to reproduce these results, he would have a lot more credibility.
Well, I'm sure it'll go to that. But I mean, what they have done is absolutely astounding. It really is astounding. There was another recent one, I believe, just prior to the tsunami. And of course, the interesting thing is the time involved. The fact that this, if it's real, this seems to be registering prior to the events, which means there's something traveling in the fourth dimension. I think. Hold on. We're at the bottom of the hour already. Charles Seif is my guest. I'm Art Bell.
I've been where the eagle flies, rode his wings across autumn skies, kissed the sun, touched the moon, but he left me much too soon. His ladybird, he left his ladybird.
Lady Bird, come on down. I'm here waiting on the ground. Lady Bird, I'll treat you good. Ah, Lady Bird, I wish you would, you Lady Bird. Pretty Lady Bird.
Lightning flashed across the sky. The night he taught me how to fly. The sun...
Just sits in your cage.
With Art Bell, call the Wildcard Line at area code 775-727-1295. The first time caller line is area code 775-727-1222. To talk with Art Bell from east of the Rockies, call toll free at 800-825-5033. From west of the Rockies, call 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Art by calling your in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5. And dialing toll-free 800-893-0903. From coast to coast and worldwide on the Internet, this is Coast to Coast AM with Art Bell.
Good morning, everybody. Charles Seif is my guest. And by the way, yes, he has a book, Alpha, actually a couple of them, Alpha and Omega, The Search for the Beginning and End of the Universe, as well as Zero. That's a good title for a book, Zero. The biography of a dangerous idea. Indeed, dangerous. We'll be right back. I don't know. When you start talking about things like quantum entanglement and the fourth dimension perhaps being time, then it seems to me that if there is something to what they appear to be discovering at Princeton, that all fits in quite comfortably.
Well, I'll confess at the outset that I'm a skeptic when it comes to telepathy and world consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, if there is some sort of world consciousness, then obviously, especially if there is something that precedes an event, there could be something that is traveling through time, some sort of signal that is traveling through time.
Uh-huh.
In fact, relativity and quantum mechanics do have very strange time effects. For example, in quantum mechanics, a particle can sense that it's entangled before it even becomes entangled.
Yeah. Through time.
Through time, yes. Uh-huh. However, if you're going to try to explain these things in quantum mechanics and try to get scientists to pay attention, what you're going to have to do is come up with a strong description, a really nice mechanism for how this happens, and try to attack and falsify that mechanism. It doesn't help to have kind of these vague senses that quantum mechanics has something to do with it. You have to say, oh, for this world consciousness to happen, particle X has to travel from the tsunami back through time and affect the counters in this way.
Yes.
And once you're able to do that and able to test that theory, then scientists will actually be able to test it and verify whether or not it's correct.
But if, just let's do that, if Princeton, if the Princeton experiments bear out, wouldn't it fit rather nicely into the whole quantum entanglement, time, fourth dimension time thing quite nicely?
It could. And then again, it might not. It's the ideas of quantum mechanics could well give you a mechanism for how this would happen if it were true.
Exactly.
But again, it has to be specific for to really understand whether it fits nicely or not.
Maybe you can answer this. You seem to be the answer man for all this sort of stuff. If we look out with our telescopes, I guess getting out toward 15 billion light years, that would be the first particles that exploded from the Big Bang. They'd be way out there at the 15 billion year mark, right?
Oh, there's actually a weird effect that makes it beyond 15 billion years. But yes, essentially that's correct.
Well, okay. So can our telescopes, have our telescopes broken the 15 billion year barrier? And if so, what seems to be past the beginning?
Well, actually, this cosmic background radiation, which comes from all parts of the universe, is like a cage of fire. It really is the earliest light that we see from the era of the Big Bang.
So, wait a minute. I need to understand this. You're saying there is something beyond that 15 billion year mark? There is radiation?
There's radiation. That 13.7 billion years ago is when the Big Bang was. And about 300,000 to 400,000 years after that, for those 300,000 to 400,000 years, the universe was a seething ball of plasma that was just glowing. And that glow is what the cosmic background radiation is. After about 370,000 years after the Big Bang, the plasma cooled, condensed, and that light flowed free. And in all directions of the sky, the entire universe was this ball of glowing plasma, and from every point in the universe.
You mean almost like somebody said, let there be light.
Exactly. It really is almost like a creation moment. All of a sudden, bang,
light flows through. Creation moment.
Yeah. Pardon me. And so the best you can do with standard telescopes is see back to about 370,000 years after the Big Bang.
But have we detected any actual physical anythings out there past that 13 billion mark?
No. Other than these spots, these over-densities and under-densities, there's no...
But basically just empty space.
Well, it's radiation. And we can't, because there were no stars or galaxies back then.
Can we actually not define it as space? In other words, if we cannot see something physical in it, how can we even call it space?
Well, because we know what temperature it was, roughly, and at that temperature, weird things aren't really going on. This is actually in the region of physics that is understood very well. That's why these models are so beautifully, that you have this great precision and predictions what this radiation looks like. And when you look up in the sky, it's exactly what you'd expect the prediction to say.
So, just so I understand, then there's radiation, but there are no physical things, so that means basically empty space. Is that...
Well, there's radiation, there's hydrogen, helium, and electrons, and a couple of other particles, but there's no stars, no galaxies, no organized larger structures.
So that really is, if you were to be able to travel to that, you would... What would happen to you as you entered or left, I guess, the universe of things into the universe of only gases and radiation?
Yeah, it would be like all of a sudden you walk past a curtain of hot gas, and everything's glowing around you. It's I'm trying to remember, about 3,000 Kelvin, so it's very hot, and so you wouldn't survive. But the first stars were coming alive took several million years after that. You had these lumps of gas would collapse, and where there's the most density, you start having this gas getting tight enough that it heats up and ignites, and the first stars are born.
Okay. Here's the part I don't understand. You're explaining to me about a place, an area, where there is nothing but gases and radiation, past what we know to be of solids, 13 billion year light years away. But we don't really know that because our information is 13 billion years old.
That's true. The information is certainly incomplete, and it's stretched and distorted by time. However, there's some really good information out there. The cosmic background radiation we've talked about a bit. But there's also, what you can do is, in these voids where there was not enough material to form galaxies, there's still some of that primordial gas floating out there. It's no longer hot and no longer ionized, but it's there. And by looking at light that's shining through those voids, you can measure the proportions of hydrogen and helium and deuterium. And you look at those, and lo and behold, they're exactly what you'd expect, given the theories of the Big Bang and inflation and all the evolution of the universe from the first few microseconds to a couple of 100,000 years. It is beautifully predicted by this theory. You look at the ratios of hydrogen to helium, helium to deuterium, and it matches your equations almost exactly. So, again, you can't know for certain that you're right. But when your theory makes this prediction, and you finally have the equipment to verify that prediction, and it comes out just right,
that's science.
That gives you a great deal of confidence.
Yeah, that's science, all right. I mean, that is science. But again, the only thing that worries me is I see all the time these stories of science retracting what previously was, well, careers were staked on it. That's the way it is, baby. Only it turns out not to be so.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's different levels of science. I mean, you mentioned the Antarctic ice sheet earlier.
Yes.
That is science that's environmental science, but it's not the fundamental way in the universe works. Scientists have been exploring this fundamental way the universe works since Newton, even before. And even though Einstein proved Newton wrong, and Einstein modified Newton's equations, Newton still holds under most circumstances. Einstein's equations, even though there were a great philosophical difference between Einstein and Newton, Einstein only is a slight change in certain conditions when things are moving very fast or things have a huge amount of mass. That's when Einstein's equations start to modify Newtonian gravity.
Why was Einstein so different than other scientists? And why are there no modern-day Einsteins? Or are there? In other words, why did we have such a unique individual who came and went, and we've never seen anything like him?
Well, Einstein was in the right place at the right time with the right mind. At the turn of the century, physics was really at a series of crisis points. Equations weren't working in several areas. The electromagnetic field equations, they worked beautifully. These were Maxwell's equations. They told you what magnetic field you'd get if you ran what electric current, and it worked right, except if you were walking or moving or moving about, and they broke down. Similarly, the predictions of how light behaves worked pretty well, but if you, under certain circumstances, they broke down. And it turns out that Einstein was able to help solve all of those problems. He is the father of relativity theory, as you know, but he's also one of the fathers of quantum theory. In 1905, his miraculous year, 100 years ago, he came up with a paper that explained a certain effect called the photoelectric effect that had baffled scientists, and it seemed to contradict all that they knew about light. And in so doing, he really gave the impetus to this burgeoning thing that became quantum theory. And also in 1905, he came up with a paper that explains the electromagnetic problem, and it became the theory of relativity. And so Einstein is special because he was at the heart of the two great intellectual developments in physics in the 20th century.
Was Einstein that much smarter than anybody living today?
I don't think so, actually. I think there are some absolute geniuses working there, working today. I speak to physicists throughout, because of my day job, all the time, and some of them just are bafflingly smart. Ed Witten, for one, is someone that everyone will always say is one of the smartest people you've met. He's a string theorist. And he has a mind that's just so penetrating. But the thing is, Einstein was, again, in just the right place at just the right time. And had you been able to transport Witten or someone else back in time, I think you would still get they would come up with relativity.
That's interesting.
And they would come up with quantum mechanics also.
Very interesting.
May not be the same person who did both. But, in fact, there were mathematicians like Poincaré who were poking around the edges of what Einstein finally discovered.
Do we have anybody today that you're aware of who is getting close to the theory of everything, that one equation?
String theory is about as close as it gets in some levels, and there are hundreds of mathematicians who are working on it. There's no one person who can lay claim to it all. But Ed Witten is among them. Juan Maldacena. Juan Maldacena, for example, I believe is responsible for realizing that what was a bunch of theories is actually one big theory. So he unified a disparate field. And if you look back, you can talk about people like John Schwartz or Michael Green, who helped build string theory from its foundations.
So do you believe that there could be an equation perhaps no longer than your thumb that could end up unifying everything, explaining virtually everything?
Could be. it's tantalizingly close in some ways.
And should we actually find this equation, should it be produced by one of these great minds, what would it mean for humanity?
Well, sadly, it really wouldn't mean all that much.
Oh, no?
No, it would be a profound insight. You'd know how all the forces in the universe behave and how they interact with each other and with matter. But would it make a better spam filter? No. I think a better spam filter would have more effect on your everyday life. There are some really, really profound things in the 20th century. For example, there's this theorem in mathematics called Gödel's incompleteness theorem, which is one of the most profound things mankind has ever created. It says that there are some things which are unknowable. And no matter what you do, you cannot prove it and you cannot disprove it. It is unknowable. It is a yes and no. And one of the big things that became a yes and no question had to do with infinities. One of the big infinity questions turned out to be incomplete in this sense. But did that really affect the way people thought about the universe? Not really.
Some things that cannot be known, period.
Yes.
It will get a yes and a no, or whatever. It's just simply unknowable.
That is correct. To give the concrete example, remember I was talking earlier about 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 is one level of infinity?
Yes.
And all the real line, pi, 1.1, all the decimals is another level of infinity?
Right.
Is there an infinity between them? And the answer is yes and no.
Yes and no.
Yes and no. You can choose one, and it's right and consistent, and you can choose the other, and it's right and consistent.
But if this is true, I mean, isn't this going to bring many scientists to draw the gun out of the drawer in their desk and blow their brains out?
It can be, actually. I mean, there's absolutely no guarantee that there is one equation that will govern all the forces and unify everything, or if there is, that we will ever find it. And there's no guarantee even that mathematics is the right tool to use to understand the universe. Scientists are going on some level of faith that these questions are knowable.
Some level of faith?
Yes.
And so if that theorem that some things are ultimately unknowable, I mean, it could definitely cause tilt in a scientist.
Absolutely.
It just can't be. That would be an end to their... Science is nothing but a series of proofs, right? So that'd be the end of that.
No more proof,
no more problems that are solvable. That's it, baby. You're up against the wall.
That's right. And a couple of years ago, a colleague of mine, John Horgan, wrote a book called The End of Science, where he said, in essence, that science in some ways was butting up against the unknowable.
The End of Science.
Yeah. It was a very interesting book. I don't agree with all of what he said. In fact, I think that the revolution in cosmology is brand new science, that this dark energy is something that is way new. But he raises some very, very interesting points.
Well, what if dark matter itself is part of that theorem?
Well, dark matter is going to be part of a unified theorem. And in fact, the candidates, like string theory, for the unified theorem, do produce natural candidates for the dark matter that's unknown. Hmm. That's part of what is getting all these people so excited. In the next decade, we may actually figure out what particle is responsible for dark matter. And if we find out, we can extend what's known as the Standard Model, which is known to not be sufficient to explain everything. And once you extend that model, you might be on the edge of a unified theory.
All right, hold it right there. We're at the top of the hour. Charles Seif is my guest, and when we come back, it's going to be up to all of you. This is the kind of guy who you can look at straight in the eye and ask, how high is this guy? And he'll proffer an answer. So it should be interesting. Lots of questions. Lots and lots of questions. I'm sure you've got them. You know the numbers. Here we are.
Riders on the storm. Riders on the storm. Into this house we're born. Into this world we're thrown. Like a dog without a bone and factor out alone. Riders on the storm. There's a killer on the road. His brain is squirming like a toad. Take a long holiday. Let your children play. If you give this man a ride, sweet mama, he will die. Thank you.